and it may or may not fit under surgical operation.
Senator Garner.
Yeah, why would it not fit under surgical? If it were, wouldn't it fit either under drug or surgical operation?
Depends what you mean by surgical operation. There is no definition of surgical operation. People have their own feelings on what that might be.
Isn't that a term of art, though, that would have been interpreted through the administrative rulings of the administrative interpretations?
It perhaps may be.
Are you familiar with those?
No, I'm not. We're also looking, though, at the situations where something very close to surgical intervention is not necessary for the abortion. There are many different ways of performing abortions. That's certainly, the reason we've raised this is I don't think the legislature has ever taken the position that abortions should be or can be performed by non-physicians. That it's, even though it's, it may, according to some literature, not be a terribly risky procedure in the first trimester, for instance, we still have not given that option to the public at large. And I think that what we're looking at here is to be sure what our law says, not leave it to ambiguous interpretation or lack of anything to cover it at all. We also have a concern, 435 sub 3, which is not reversed by the court in Benson versus Johnson. It's on page 2 at the top of my submitted remarks. It says that the refusal of any person to consent to a termination of pregnancy or to submit thereto shall not be grounds for loss of any privilege or immunity to which the person is otherwise entitled, nor shall consent to or submission to a termination of pregnancy be imposed as a condition to the receipt of any public benefits. I think this is an extremely important item to keep in our law so that the woman on welfare does not feel pushed or threatened into getting an abortion in order to receive her benefits, either total welfare benefits or some kind of medical care. The same is true of the minor who might maybe a ward of the court should not be feel that she can be pressured by the caseworker into getting an abortion in any particular instance. Without this section, I think we're, especially by repealing it, absolutely indicating that the legislature may well be in favor of using that as some kind of a threat in some cases.
What so, ostensibly is the grounds for repealing this provision? We had testimony that every provision in this bill that is being repealed has a judicial basis.
I don't see this as being one that's been reversed by Benson versus Johnson. It was not mentioned. Benson versus Johnson reversed sections 1 and 2 of this particular subsection 435, but did not reverse the subsection 3, and I think it's important that it remain in.
Thank you.
435.455, I believe, was reversed by the court, but it does describe acts prohibit persons other than doctors from performing abortions and prohibits persons aiding a woman to a self-abortion, which I don't think, again, the legislature has taken a position that anyone other than a doctor should be performing abortions. ORS 435.495 is another provision that was not mentioned in Benson versus Johnson at all. This section requires the health division to require reports and to then put those reports together in a statistical manner. I think that's been of help to everyone in this area over the last 10 years by giving us an indication of the number of abortions in Oregon, some idea of which ones of those are to the young girls, which ones to older women, to married women, whether or not contraceptives are used. It gives us some idea of why people are getting abortions and the numbers they are and whether or not this is increasing or decreasing in Oregon each year.
Can I point something out?
That helps.
Excuse me. It's our counsel has a question.
Yes.
One confusion is that Benson is a 1973 case, which was held up for Roe and Doe, and a lot of the provisions that are being taken out in this bill are the result of cases that came after Benson. So you shouldn't, I think that's misrepresenting the position.
I don't know of any case that's reversed 435.435 sub 3, nor 435.495.
Well, I want to talk about 495.
Let's go back to 435.435 sub 3 at the top of the page. Does anyone present have any knowledge of any?
Could I just respond?
Yes.
I just got the statute here. I think the part that they probably want to repeal is this written consent part, because there's been numerous court cases holding consent requirements to be unconstitutional.
Well, they have.
Husband consent and this kind of thing.
But is the bill broad enough to repeal subsection 3?
Yes, it
repeals. And then we have the same problem we had 2 years ago and over breath, apparently.
I believe that's the case.
Okay.
What I specifically wanted to respond to was 495, because...
Okay, as to 495.
There is, I think, some language in Planned Parenthood versus Danforth that would deal with that. The other more pertinent thing, perhaps, is that our own Senate Bill 30, which is the Health Division's Vital Statistics Bill, the Health Division itself is revising the way that it compiles these statistics, so in line with Danforth and other uniform national reporting standards. So 495, I think, is taken care of in the Vital Statistics Bill from the Health Division and is in response to Danforth and not in response to Benson or anything that happened in 73.
You're saying that in this Danforth case there's some indication that either expressed or implied that a reporting statute such as this is unconstitutional?
I think Mr. Walters is going to speak. Danforth is a case that has to do with record keeping, and Danforth and cases that come after it have talked about confidentiality and the way that records may and may not be kept. And I know that the Health Division's motivation in Senate Bill 30 and those abortion reporting requirements, and there's some substantial changes. You might want to look at that bill if you haven't already.
I would like to look at that. Well, although it
changes the abortion reporting requirements in that bill in a very substantial way so that this section wouldn't be necessary, probably.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hendrickson.
Yeah, getting back to 435.3, I share Rita's concern about that, but I got thinking about the recent decision that just came down on the abortion funding issue, in which they, under the state constitution privilege and immunities clause, they said the state could not discriminate between the services offered pregnant women seeking services to continue their pregnancies and those seeking to terminate. So it seems to me, in view of that decision, this language is now redundant because they'd be protected under the constitution.
I don't see that would necessarily be the case. I think they would probably be protected under the constitution, but I think it doesn't hurt, and especially, and it very much helps to have this language remain in our statute, so it's very clear to everyone what the state of Oregon means, as opposed to having a woman be discriminated against, be forced to have
right
an abortion.
Right now, the state is telling them
court.
They have to have the children if they're going to get welfare. They can't get an abortion, or at least not more than one.
No.
Or they did before the decision.
This bill was drafted before that decision.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that decision may impact. Maybe our council could look into that.
The question, of course, is that the fact that something is permitted by the Constitution doesn't preclude a statutory expression of that same right.
Another provision that was not reversed by Benson versus Johnson or any other case I'm aware of regulates emergency-induced abortions and requires an appropriate report to be made to the hospital or health division of the circumstances. I think this is especially necessary in the case where a woman may come in who's not able at that point in time to make her own consent decision that's made by other family members or in some other way in caring for her. I think it's especially appropriate that information be recorded and properly reported so that she can feel secure that all the proper steps were taken care of if she's not able to be competent that particular moment, the competence to make that decision. I'm beginning to address the sections that were ruled by Benson versus Johnson to be unconstitutional. Now, Benson versus Johnson said certain of the items in those provisions were unconstitutional, but there are a number of items that could be and probably should be salvaged, and the court indicated they possibly could be, but didn't want to go to the trouble or couldn't go to the trouble of rewriting those particular statutes. One of the statutes required that or said that no pregnancy shall be terminated after the 150th day of pregnancy except to save the life of the mother. That particular provision can be kept pretty much except to add health of the mother. Second, that a report be sent to the district attorney if there is any reason to believe the pregnancy was a result of felonious intercourse. A third, a woman give written consent before an abortion. Without that particular provision, I don't know that there is any requirement that the consent be written in Oregon. Fourth, that written consent be given before an abortion by a guardian of a person who's been declared a mentally incompetent person. Again, without that particular provision, I don't know there's any requirement for written consent. And fifth, requiring any such written consents to become part of the hospital record. That would seem to make good sense and be good protection for everyone. This bill also takes any mention of the particular provisions of ORS 435 405, et cetera, out of a couple of other statutes, and that has some implications. It removes that mention from ORS 109.660, and if amended to that point, would allow a minor of 15 or older to consent to an abortion without notification to or consent of her parent or guardian. Consent is probably invalid and could not be enforced at the present time without some changes to the statute, but certainly notification could be. And it presumably is being taken care of. I don't know whether they actually are adhering to that these days. ORS 677.190 would take away as a ground for suspension or revocation of a license to practice medicine, aiding a woman to self-abortion, a failure to get written consent of a woman before an abortion, or a failure to get written consent of the parents or guardian, if applicable. I wanted to stress again that 397 is no more housekeeping measure this session than it was last session. This bill, other than with the addition of Section 7 at the very end, which is primarily technical and not substantive material, is exactly the same word for word as that bill that was defeated by the Senate on the Senate floor last session. We would ask that this bill be defeated or at least tabled, or in the third alternative, that it be extensively revised before being submitted to the floor.
Are there questions? Senator Hendrickson.
If it was revised, would you support the bill then?
I don't know. It depends how extensively it were revised.
There's a lot
to deal with it here. We would prefer to, I don't know. In some ways, we'd prefer to leave it as it is unless it can be revised quite carefully. So it would very much depend on the extent of the revisions. Thank you.
Stephen Walters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm still Stephen Walters, still appearing on behalf of the Oregon American Civil Liberties Union. I am before you now to urge very strongly a do pass vote on Senate Bill 397. I have submitted written testimony that you should have before you. I will not repeat the substance of that testimony here. I do think it's important to stress, however, that with respect to the bulk of the provisions that would be repealed by Senate Bill 397, there are provisions that were specifically held unconstitutional by the United States District Court for the District of Oregon in Benson versus Johnson in 1973. You have heard testimony which has suggested that there have been left provisions of ORS Chapter 435 that require that abortions be performed by physicians. That simply is not true. The specific provision of ORS Chapter 435, which referred to that, was subsection 3 of 435.415, which required not only that an abortion be performed by a licensed physician, but also that it would be performed in a hospital. That provision was an identical provision was held unconstitutional in Doe versus Bolton and struck down by the district court in Benson versus Johnson. So that provision is no longer the law. To the extent there is a requirement in Oregon that abortions be performed by physicians, it is the Medical Practices Act, and as Senator Gardner referred, if there is a basis for interpreting the Medical Practices Act as permitting medical procedures which the legislature believes ought to be performed by a physician, then that is the place to start, and not by leaving on the books a statute which has been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States and a United States District Court. There was testimony concerning some of the provisions that weren't specifically affected by the order that was issued by the court in Benson versus Johnson. It's important to note that the opinion in that case limited its discussion only to those sections that were specifically before the court. It didn't say that the remaining provisions were constitutional. It simply said that it wasn't passing on those at this time. If you look carefully at those sections, the sections that weren't addressed specifically by Benson versus Johnson that Senate Bill 397 would repeal, they are provisions that depend or that don't have independent significance from the provisions that were declared unconstitutional. For example, the record-keeping provision that was testified about refers to reports regarding the operation of ORS 435.405 to 435.495, most of which was declared unconstitutional in Benson versus Johnson. And it's difficult to imagine of what use reports concerning unconstitutional statutes would have. It's a provision that no longer can stand by itself because the other sections have been declared unconstitutional. Similarly, with respect to the definitions section, 435.405, that provides definitions that are used in sections of statutes which have been declared unconstitutional. Again, they don't have independent legal significance. With respect to 435.445, which is the provision relating to emergency terminations of pregnancy by physicians, that is a provision that only has any significance if you assume that the other limitations on terminations of pregnancy, that is the 150-day requirement, this requirement of certification by two physicians, the requirement of regardless of the stage of the pregnancy, first trimester, second trimester, or whatever, that the pregnancy is terminated, that certain specified conditions exist, such as possibility of mental or physical defect. It is only by assuming that those have vitality that 445 has any significance at all.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Senator Hendricks.
The one I was really concerned about is 435.4353. I don't know. Do you have the statute in front of you?
I do.
It's obvious the first part of it have been declared, well, most of the first parts of it have explicitly been declared unconstitutional with respect to written consents. But the policy statement of not requiring a person to consent to a termination of pregnancy or to protect them from a loss of any privilege and immunity to me seems like a wise policy statement. Of course, I would also put the other side of the coin is that you can't refuse people abortions and deny them. But I do sort of feel that, and the United States Supreme Court has not been very good on this in terms of benefits for abortion, and allowing people to be refused the benefit of having medical aid for abortions, which you could just do the flip side of that and do childbirth. But the Oregon court has recently ruled that the privilege and immunities of our state constitution would protect people, I believe, in this kind of an instance. And I just wonder if you had an opinion, because I think this is an important policy statement that people shouldn't be forced either into having or not having abortions.
I agree with everything you said, Senator. Yeah. I agree, first of all, that yes, it's an important policy statement. I agree with you also that yes, it should be expanded if it is left as a statute of Oregon to include terminations of pregnancy. I agree with you that yes, Planned Parenthood versus Department of Human Resources, I was one of the counsel in that case, would cover a situation in which there were some attempt by some official of government to deny benefits because a woman would not have an abortion. It would apply equally there. And furthermore, there are probably about 40 years of United States Supreme Court cases, beginning with Skinner versus Oklahoma, which prohibited forced sterilization, that would apply to this section. The concerns expressed here are valid ones. They should be expanded if they are kept, but they are completely unnecessary, and I think that is why the bill included those sections as well. Sections 1 and 2 of 435 are the ones that the court in Benson versus Johnson held are declared unconstitutional. With the remainder of my time, I would like to just stress the importance of repealing these statutes that have been declared unconstitutional, that are essentially dead letters, and the other sections of the statute, which really do not have independent legal significance, because they can have a real effect on the exercise of constitutional rights. As I mentioned in my written testimony, I am personally aware of an incident which a women's clinic I was representing, I was informed by the state health division that they could not perform abortions because they, under 435.115(3), abortions had to be performed in hospitals. Fortunately, they had access to counsel, and they came to me, and we wrote a letter, and they checked with the Attorney General's office, and they came back, and they agreed with us. But not all women who need abortions, not all physicians, not all providers of health care have access to informed legal counsel in this area. I think that the testimony you've heard today is an indication of the fact that there is some confusion about what the law is relating to the constitutional right to choose abortion. These statutes should be removed from the books if the legislature undertakes to draft new statutes at some time to deal with matters such as parental notification of unemancipated and immature minors. It should do so separately from this provision, because none of these provisions refer to that, and the ones that refer to consent have all been declared unconstitutional. If it is concerned about a policy statement, such as Senator Hendrickson referred to, it should be drafted to include all rights to reproductive freedom in the context of public benefits. It shouldn't be left a piecemeal, disjointed, and unenforceable statute shouldn't be left on the books to deter people in the exercise of their constitutional rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Are there any comments upon closing the hearing on Senate Bill 397?
No, just I would like to get a copy of that recent abortion opinion that came down.
Okay. We'll now close the hearing on Senate Bill 397 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 557. And this was bill was introduced at the request of Mr. Evel Maligon, Esquire of Eugene, Oregon. And I'm the chief sponsor, but actually the chief sponsor of this is Representative Hanlon, who's here today, and got caught afoul of the overly speedy bill filing requirements in the House, and so he came over to seek some relief. Would you two gentlemen like to come up together? Tell us about this bill. Sorry to keep you waiting, but we kept Mrs. Radich waiting for quite a long time, and I didn't want to have anybody feel we were
Mr. Chair.
People wait from out of town.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Hanlon, State Representative, District 2. To my right is Ev Maligon, Lawyer Eugene. For the purposes of the bill, the very first thing I want to do, because I checked with legislative counsel, in order to have the bill do what it was intended to do, at line 24 after ORS 30.265 sub 3, an additional statute is needed to be inserted, and that is ORS 656.018. I talked with Mr. Wilson at Legislative Council and have his authority to say that that is correct, and I've been so advised by Legislative Council. The purpose of the bill, if I might just briefly do an overview and then turn it over to Mr. Maligon, is to...
Does that statutory reference abolish the Workers' Comp Board?
let me take both of those.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. It's getting to be that hour.
We got
to
be all safe for 2:40 here.
The ORS 30. The ORS 30 reference refers to a statute which says if you're covered by any comp, then you may not sue a public body. The ORS 656 reference that I just gave you is the exclusive provision of the workers' comp statute, which means if you're covered by comp, there can be no other lawsuits. This bill, to make it clear, this bill does not abolish tort immunity for the workers' comp department, which provides for $100,000 limits, just like any other public body. This bill abolishes the immunity that provides one can sue, cannot sue the department in any situation. This is a narrow bill. It applies to rehab services only. I suppose.
Senator Henderson.
I wasn't aware that they had. They still had immunity. They're different than other agencies. Then they're immune from torts. They're not liable for their torts.
It is my understanding that, and I stand to be corrected by counsel, it's my understanding that they are that the workers' comp department is a public body and therefore falls under the same provisions of the $100,000 for any one injury, $300,000 overall out of one incident.
Oh, I see. You're trying to raise the tort of the liability limits in
that,
this case.
That's correct.
Okay. I thought you were saying they had some kind of immunity.
They do have immunity at present.
Just on the limits, though. The limits they're
no.
Liable. No.
No. They have limits period. Because of the exclusive remedy under workers' comp.
And additionally, because a worker that is injured cannot sue a public body, period. If I give you a quick example of that, if a logger busts up his leg working for Crown Zellerbach and he's covered by workers' comp for that. Let's say that it's a bad break and they haul them into the University of Oregon Med School, a public body, and the doctors make a mistake and cut off the wrong leg. Under existing law, that worker has no right to sue the U of O Med School because
for
of...
For a separate tort? Not for, related? Oh, simply because it is considered related because it was
in the course of the treatment. No. That worker is not covered, but...
30
That's a bad example, though, because the Health Sciences Center is expressly within, I think, the Tort Claims Act.
Yeah, but he's saying you can't sue them at all.
Under, if you look
That's
at...
That's what's confusing me, because usually 30, when they waive sovereign immunity, they did for all state agencies, and you can sue them as tort sues like anybody else, but you're saying over and above this, there's something in the work comp law that prevents them from
this
going
is what
to
you're
the
using.
Department?
Yes, the two provisions that prevent suit are ORS 30.265 sub 3 and specifically sub 3A. The other provision that prevents suit against the department is 656.018, where it's the exclusivity part of the workers' comp statute in particular sub 3 says the exemption from liability given an employer under this section is also extended to insurer department and the employee's officers and directors of the employer and the employer's insurer and the department. So you can't sue
for
them.
Anything, even intentional tort.
If that's the way the present law reads, it doesn't make an exception for intentional torts. You may want to construe that along with the 656.156, which is the deliberate intention statute of the workers' comp law. That. Though only applies to the employer. So it doesn't apply to the department. The way the statutes are written, it appears one has no lawsuit against the department.
30.265 says every public body and its officers, employees, and agents acting within the scope of their employment or duties are immune for liability for any claim or injury to or death of any person covered by any workers' compensation law.
And, well, this is a question that I posed to Mr. Malagon. His answer was that they're interpreting that, at Callahan Center, say, they're interpreting that to mean that the person is there covered by workers' comp, and the recovery is under workers' comp,
even though
the injury isn't covered by workers' comp at all.
That
doesn't seem right.
No,
why
doesn't.
Is that a claim for injury covered by any workers' compensation law? That's what I don't understand. Why is that incident covered?
I can respond to that, Senator Gardner. There's
a
1960, I believe 65 case, Widmer versus I've forgotten who. It is a case that stands, it's a civil case that stands for the proposition that it was a malpractice case against a doctor by an injured worker, and it stands for the proposition, no, I guess I may have that backwards. What it stands for is the proposition that the negligence of a doctor in the treatment of a workers' compensation injury is covered by the workers' compensation insurance that first covered that injury because it is a compensable consequence of that injury.
So you can't therefore sue
wipes
the
it
guy.
Out. And therefore wipes it out. That's an earlier, I believe.
So this is just an extension of that doctrine, really, and applied against a public.
So really, it's unfair game to have people commit malpractice.
That's correct within this particular statutory setup.
The director of the Callahan Center is here. Maybe, would you like to comment on this?
Yeah. That's correct. Well, everything Richard said is correct. It's interpreted as an extension.
Could you give your name for the tape, please?
Gerald Repka, administrator of the Callahan Center, representing the Department of Workers' Compensation. If I may?
Sure.
What Representative Hanlon said is correct, and I was going to raise that issue. We share his concerns in that area, but from a different standpoint.
We look at sit in that chair there so you can get closer to the
we look at it as an extension of the claim, the department. As far as Callahan Center is concerned, notwithstanding what Representative Hanlon said as far as malpractice and the other thing, it's a different issue. But we look at it as an extension of the claim, basically to separate workers'
club have frequent meetings. Maybe we could ask to have an opportunity to come and make a presentation.
I don't think they have.
I think they had a special briefing.
I think it may have just been.
I think it'd be important, though, that for that particular one, for Dave Frohnmayer, perhaps, to sit down with, say, Gary Conkling and Pat McCormick and see people like that to just point out that I'm confident, doesn't apply to that. Aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
It does not apply to that. Yeah.
We don't have a quorum here, so I'm going to adjourn.
I'll see you.